are listening to a free version of Majority Report with Sam Steeter. To support the show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeter. It's time to look in the mirror, America. Do you like what you see?
I keep referring to Obama as the magic Negro.
Do you like what you see now?
Well, suck on this.
It's just a mirror, America.
Shared sacrifice by everybody.
What could it do to you except reflect your image?
I did nothing wrong at the Minneapolis airport.
The Majority Report.
Far more credible to me than PBS and Frontline.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeter.
If I get the feeling you've been cheated.
It is Thursday, April 10th, 2014. My name is Sam Steeter. This is the three-time award-winning Majority Report. And we are broadcasting live, not in the literal nor metaphorical shadow of the New York Times building in the fashionable Dollar Lunch District of New York City, but in the Lafitte Ballroom of the eminent Wynn Hotel in Las Vegas. Ladies and gentlemen, I am here to attend and I guess talk to some people at the Mass Sports Conference 2014. As you know, this is a conference that Mike Papantonio, my co-host from Ring of Fire, is heavily involved in. And so I come down here, do a little work for Ring of Fire, and get an opportunity to talk over the years to just a wide array of people who are involved in being trial lawyers and also some politicos who are here. And I should warn you folks right up front that it seems like no matter how much preparation I do, no matter how many times I go through and how many checklists I make, how many times I double check things, when I am doing a remote broadcast, there is just always seems to be some type of problem with the technical aspects of it. And today, it was my trusty 2008 MacBook Pro, which could not seem to find any of my home folder stuff today. And so I am in complete disarray. I have none of the access to my materials. However, I have something even better than that sitting at the table with me. It's not Scott Milliken, producer of Ring of Fire. Sitting with me now is RJ Eskow. He is a fellow at the Campaign for America's Future and also the host of the recently launched Zero Hour, which is on We Act Radio, which is Washington, D.C., AM 1480. And so, RJ, so glad that you could join us today. I've always been a big fan of your work.
Likewise.
You are one of the, you have been hammering about Wall Street from the get-go in a way that we don't see from, I think, enough people out there. And now, you have a background, right? You worked at AIG, is that it?
I worked at AIG. I worked at a couple other companies that were Wall Street-based. My background was originally social insurance, healthcare, health insurance, HMOs, retirement, which comes in very useful when we're talking about Social Security and people have opinions. It's nice to have a little more than opinions. Public policy, I used to do that kind of work in 20 different countries for the State Department, World Bank. But I was based on Wall Street, also did some investment work, that kind of thing. So I got to be around during that culture, that 1990s boom, go-go culture of investment and banking. Got to see that firsthand, and I think that's why I was cynical very early on when everybody said after the 2008 crisis, now we're going to have meaningful reform, now people will have learned their lesson, the bad guys are going to go to jail. That's not how these guys work.
All right, well, I mean, let's talk about that. I mean, what do you think So from that perspective, what would you say are some of the biggest reasons why that didn't happen? I mean, from my perspective, Eric Holder, and either as a reflection of the administration at large or simply because he's just one of those guys, they subscribe to this notion of too big to jail, literally. And I think they've articulated that in many respects.
Right. Well, you know, I've hammered Holder and Obama because you have to follow the chain of responsibility up for so long. I was so much of an outlier on that one. Back in 2009, I think it was, I started saying, for example, that the Justice Department's Financial Fraud Task Force was a fraud itself, which it was, and the Columbia Journalism Review and other people did really good work on this. But I've been hammering those guys for so long, it's become a refrain. But and of course, a lot of people have been on that beat with me. I'm not taking sole credit for it. But look, I think the fact is, if they wanted to prosecute, they could have. We know Bill Black, the great regulator and law professor, points out all the time that he was headed the investigations that put 1,000 people in jail during the much smaller savings and loan scandal. During this crisis, not a single banker, we all know this stuff, has gone through. Why, you know, your question is, why hasn't that happened? I mean, I think the answer is very simply, we had a candidate in Barack Obama, who little notice to all of us, and I've also hammered Obama so much, I feel like I should stop. I'm a one-note Johnny by now. But we have a guy who ran, little be known to us, raised more money than any previous candidate had from Wall Street. And I think there had to be an understanding that, look, I'm going to go easy on you guys. We're going to get things back on track. That's what's happened. I mean, people interpret, when I say that sort of thing or you say that sort of thing, people often say, well, you know, you hate Obama or you hate, or you're this or you're that. No, I refuse to be categorized by that statement. I don't hate anybody. I just think I see them. And I right. think what we see here were agreements that went contrary to the will and the best interest of the American people. And I think it's getting too late to prosecute a lot of the bank fraud that led to the 2008 crisis. So if something doesn't happen quickly, we still need to hammer that story. We still need to find out what happened, because it's a story of political reform and what's needed.
You know, I mean, maybe this is getting too sort of into the weeds. And I mean, I think maybe it's enough to simply say they weren't interested in this agenda in terms of pursuing the bankers. And maybe it's irrelevant whether or not it's simply there is a cultural belief amongst the elites that they're just too important, and that the mistakes that they made were mistakes as opposed to anything that was malicious. And it's just, that's the nature of the way that our economy operates at that level. And it's just like, you got to cut a guy a slack, you know, it's like he shanked the ball. And so you give him a drop.
I think there's a huge piece of it. You know, I wrote a piece, I want to go back to this in my writing. I wrote a piece about 2 years ago called 147 People, because there's an anthropologist who says the largest number of human beings you can really know that can really be part of your social group is between 147 and 230.
I can tell you the lowest from personal experience is somewhere around like half of one person.
Okay, well, that's, and that one person is yourself, because who truly knows themselves?
Well, I also.
But my point being that these guys all know each other. This is their social circle. It's Obama, right, and it's Holder, and it's whose clients as an attorney were Jamie Dimon and right, Lloyd Blankfein and so on. So it's not so much people think it's an evil conspiracy. It's what Disraeli or somebody called a conspiracy of shared values. It's that these are the guys you hang out with. These are the guys you have dinner with. These are the guys you summer with in the Hamptons or wherever. you know, yeah, look, it's like you and me. I mean, it's like, you know, okay, Sam, you screwed up, all right? Okay, right. I'll bail you out, all right, this time. But I want you to be a little more careful. And by next year, both you and I have forgotten the entire incident, and much less the conversation, and it's business as usual. I think that's a huge piece of what we're seeing today.
And with that, with that sort of reality, and this 147 people, for lack of a better way of sort of pegging them,
that's the name of my next book. Now, don't steal it. And none of you people listening, don't steal it. I've got a book proposal.
That actually
already.
Would have been a very good. It would also
I'm
be great.
On it.
Do you have the 147 people?
Like, do you well, you know what it is? Think of it as like overlapping circles, right?
Where right.
My 147 people overlaps a lot with yours, but it's not the same exact
right.
147. So it's more like the shifting circles always move, but they're always going in the same direction.
I mean, it's funny because the other day I spoke to Zoe Carpenter from The Nation about the. She had a piece about fake populists, and many of whom are in the Democratic Party. They'll talk a populist game, and they will not implement. So, for instance, a guy like Chuck Schumer, he'll be talking about minimum wage, and he'll be
right.
talking about a couple of small board, but important, almost reforms. I wouldn't even call them reforms necessarily. They're almost sort of like it's spackle on a it's spackle on a wall. It's important. But it's not fundamentally affecting the structure of the wall. In other words, if you're going to really deal with things like income
right.
inequality, it's going to take more than just expanding the definition of who is of what overtime is for workers in
right.
our society. It's going to take more than just minimum wage, for that matter. It's going to take more than just you know, federal contractors' equal pay measures. It's going to take doing things like pushing for laws that make it easier to unionize. It's going to take things like taxing millionaires or changing the notion of capital gains versus
right.
income. I mean, there's a whole raft of more structural things.
It's going to change, require regulatory change. It's going to require real law enforcement for white-collar crime. Absolutely. I mean, there's a, I hate this phrase, but it's a paradigm shift in a sense. What you get, I mean, I've often felt that, I mean, two things about this. One is that I talk to economists who work for these guys or people who are still in the banking system. The elites, especially in the financial world, they're genuinely scared right now. They genuinely see a level of instability that frightens them at the same time that I think they don't want to let go of what they have. And then you, so you have, I think, this...
So they see an instability in the context of there's a lot of agitation about income inequality.
I would say the opposite. I would say they see very little agitation, but they see the numbers, and they wonder when the agitation is coming, because they see the growing disparities. They're not stupid guys, I mean,
right.
by any means. They see the growing disparity in wealth. They see the rising poverty numbers. They see the ongoing long-term unemployment. Long-term unemployment is a subset of unemployment at record levels. They see underemployment and wage stagnation at record levels. They're not stupid. They understand that at some point, this could lead to real social unrest, and this is why they so reacted so intensely to Wall Street. I mean, when you started having even the hint of, you know, Wall Street goes by Jamie Dimon being the CEO of
J.P.
Morgan, Occupy Wall Street going by Jamie Dimon's townhouse.
Right.
You know, this terrifies them. Okay,
this is why they're calling Aaron Sorkin or Adam Sorkin or whatever. Can you go check out and see if I'm in mortal
right.
danger down there?
Okay. Absolutely. Yeah. And Andrew Ross Sorkin. But yeah, absolutely. And so there's that genuine fear. And so I look at the Republicans and Democrats as being. I mean, the Republicans are just nakedly a pathogen, you know, for this, you know, economic disease. The Democrats like Schumer, and I think most of the national Democrats that you and I would talk about, I almost see them as trying to immunize society against more fundamental change. In other words, they want to give a little bit out so that...
They're letting the air out of the tire.
They're like, okay, I'm giving you this, all right? I know it seems hopeless right now. I know you feel, Mr. and Mrs. America, like you got no future, but here's a... you know, here's $9 for your minimum wage, okay, which was Obama's original proposal, not 10, 10, or 15,
right,
but
that
nine.
Came out of the Senate. Right.
Right. So, you know, that's what I see them doing a lot. It's an inoculation against economic change. And so you see, then you get the sort of insurgence, of whether it's an independent like Bernie Sanders or Elizabeth Warren, you get those people coming in. That's why they're so outraged, because they feel like they've had free run of the Democratic Party for and the political system, the quote-unquote leftish wing of the political system for so many years, that's almost a social affront to come along and say, no, that's not good enough. We want more.
Right. So a couple of things I want to ask you about. So when you say that the elite on Wall Street are aware, essentially, they're basically saying, like, the weather patterns are such that a big storm could be coming. We don't necessarily see it, but the weather patterns are such that it sets that up. So when we hear guys like Ken Langone and I can't remember the
Tom Perkins,
they just are morons within that group. Is that I mean, do you think guys like that are conscious of, I got to try and tamp this down, and they just have 10 ears on how to do
it? Yes, I think it's more.
Or do you think that they're just, they're not the guys who sort of even recognize that the weather patterns are such that it would bring about this storm? They just think that, like, why are people running around saying there's going to be a storm? They're idiots.
It's a little bit of all of the above, depending on who you're talking about specifically. But I think that, you know, the one thing that I got really, really wrong after 2008, and I like kind of trade on my ability to predict what's going to happen, whether it's economically or politically or whatever. I'm pretty good. But one thing I totally blew is that after 2008, when Obama was using the anti-banker rhetoric, but protecting them in a lot of ways, left and right, and doing a very mild reform, Democrats did a very mild reform law in Dodd-Frank. I kept saying, you know, you started seeing these stories, the Wall Street executives and the CEOs are upset because they don't like the rhetoric. My reaction was, nah, they'll never get upset. They'll never get angry. As long as the money starts flowing back in, I know these guys, trust me. You put the money in their pocket, you can call them any name you want. Boy, was I wrong. So the other element of this is genuine rage and fury on the part of the ultra-rich. How dare you?
Right.
Criticize me. But to me, that's
they've moved beyond being rich into some form of sort of, there's a certain divine right there. Like, you
absolutely
can't speak that way of the king.
Right. Which, again, you know, I mean, it's so interesting because if you dig down, that kind of rage and self-entitlement, underneath it could be an element of fear, too. I mean, I'm not a psychologist, but you look at that. So you look at, for example, Tom Perkins, the billionaire or near billionaire Silicon Valley investor who went on a rampage about San Francisco and you know, what he was really talking about was, what really sparked his fury was that his ex-wife, Danielle Steele, the romance novelist, with whom he's still friendly, I was one of the first guys to notice this. He kept saying, well, the radical rabble-rousers in the San Francisco Chronicle have been even attacking my ex-wife. So I looked it up. Boy, did Danielle Steele's site, Chronicle.com, you know, Chronicle.com. You know what came up? The only thing that came up? In their style section, there was a small piece on the website about how she's let her hedges, she's grown them so big and ostentatious, and she has a historic house right near a public park that they're actually crowding out the sidewalks that people use when they're walking around the public park. So it was like, why does this lady not trim her head? It didn't say rich lady it just said, you know, who's this lady who's kind of aristocratic? My hedges can push you off into the street and I don't care. And they were big. They looked like big poodle legs or something, you know. And that was it. By you dare criticize my woman's hedges, you know, I shall thrash you. You know, I mean, that was the psychology.
Right. There is just a sense that, like, you're all just part of my playthings here.
And that any form of criticism, even in this case, aesthetic, architectural, gets into a kind of white noise of they hate us, they hate us, they hate us, which is very interesting when you think about it.
Right, I want to...
The hedges were ugly, by the way. I saw the pictures.
Oh, did you actually go?
No, I didn't go, but I saw the pictures. They were ghastly. They really did look like big poodle legs, you know, 20 feet tall or something. Ugly.
And, all right, so...
And
now you're going to set Tom Perkins off again.
I appreciate a well-trimmed hedge as much as the next person, but these were not well-trimmed.
Yes, and hedges, of course, are the sort of the hallmark of the feudal order, right? I mean, this is supposed to keep the peasants. This is basically like the moat. Right?
And you can also insert your own hedge fund joke in here if you like. Yeah.
All right, but wait a second.
Sorry.
I want to get to...
You're the professional on that.
I want to get to the part about people like Schumer, because one of the questions I had for Zoe Carpenter when we were talking about this that I don't quite think I have a grasp on is that when you say that they're letting the air out of tires, maybe that's my phrasing, but basically
right.
by
inoculate
saying,
was my phrase,
yes,
yeah.
that they're going to throw they're going to provide small bore measures that will hopefully tampen down sort of the hue and outcry that everybody anticipates coming and feels is simmering under the surface. How conscious of that is that what they're doing? In other words, can you tell from the machinations? In other words, we hear President Obama talk about income inequality, and then he switches rather quickly to opportunity because income inequality is it's almost class war.
Because you got to push back, I think. Yeah.
And do they know that they're avoiding really the real solutions and that they're offering just sort of small morsels to sort of...
You know, I think it's an extension of the political psychology of the last how many hundred years, right? Meaning that if you're Chuck Schumer or somebody, it's like, look, I think everybody thinks, most people think they're a good guy, right? Or a person. You know, Chuck Schumer probably thinks he's a good... Hey, look, you don't know what I got to go through, because I'm a senator from New York, I got to get money from Wall Street.
Right.
I got to make those guys happy. Plus, I got to make you troublemakers on the left happy with the minimum wage, this and that. I think it's more that, and you know what? You don't like what I do, where are you going to go?
Right.
So I think it's more that than it is any kind of conscious, well, we got to tamp it down. But, you know, I think a guy like Obama, I think he wanted stronger rhetoric. We heard for weeks his State of the Union was going to be the income inequality is the right. defining challenge. Part-time. Then it was like equal opportunity, which is, it's a right-wing meme. It's, you know, let the guy who starts 300 yards back from the starting line because right. of historical unfairness, and let him have equal opportunity as the one who's sitting 300 yards in front of the starting line in a limousine. You know, I mean, it's also a silly phrase.
I mean, I think that actually it goes beyond that, because when you say equal opportunity, the implication is, we're going to back off of things.
Right.
Or maybe give a little bit of a help to
right.
certain people or clear the way. I mean, that's what equal
right,
opportunity
right.
is.
Right.
Clear the way. And what it does is it works in two different ways, because it not only implies we should be a less proactive government, it also implies that government is already not tipping the scales in favor
right.
of, you know,
good point.
It both says we're not going to be in the business of picking winners and losers. We're going to let it happen. And it also sort of hides the fact that, in fact, not only are you not, you have been actively engaging picking winners. I mean, the bottom
right.
line is governments always pick winners. They
right.
always do. It is impossible to have a society that is not structured in such a way that it picks winners and losers. And it's just a question of over the past 30 years, 40 years, the winners that government is picking has been a narrower set of people than
right.
it used to be. Right? I mean, that's...
Right. And it's almost inevitable. I mean, if something significant isn't done to reverse it, it's almost inevitable. It's like a black hole formation. You know, I mean, you almost get to a point where you reach an event horizon of aggregation of wealth and power. If something doesn't step in to stop it, you've got it becomes irreversible, and a society and an economy are in danger of collapse. So, I mean, I look at some of these guys, and I'm, you know, again, I don't know the ultra elite, but from what I hear from those who do, I get a sort of murky picture. But one sense is that on some level they understand that there could be, I hate this phrase too, but a tipping point beyond which this black hole problem, as I call it, becomes irreversible and things collapse. On the other hand, they really want the money. You know, so I think you've got this kind of, oh, I'll take a little more here and a little more there, and then we'll, you know, like an addiction problem kind of overlaid on top of it. So,
and I guess also, I mean, you know, it's interesting because I have an old friend who, it's been a long time since I spoke, but he made an incredible amount of money. And he was a sort of like, I think he was surprised that he was supportive of Obama. In fact, I don't think he voted for Obama the first time around. But I think within the first term, and he was a guy who sort of did tax insurance schemes. I don't want to say
right.
It's not. It wasn't illegal, but it was sort of setting up tax havens. I couldn't quite follow
right,
it.
Right.
But he was quite happy with Obama. He's like, look, you know, I think he's done well. I mean, he was happy with the way it went. But he would also say, like, we're probably going to have to, this country's probably going to have to move to some form of socialized medicine down the road, which he was not necessarily happy about. He certainly wasn't inclined to do anything or have any politics that would sort of, like, lessen whatever he saw was coming. I mean, it was sort of a fascinating sort of, like, the implication is if I have enough money, I can build high enough walls that no matter what comes or what I say now, I'll still be able to keep the hordes away. I mean, you know, metaphorically speaking, but probably not so metaphorically speaking.
No, I think there's a lot of I mean, look, gated. I've done several trips to South Africa. And what you see in South Africa could be a harbinger in some ways here. I mean, obviously, the overall poverty level when people are impoverished there is staggering by American standards. But you have a small minority. It's still, the wealth distribution has stayed on from the apartheid days. So basically, everybody with any kind of money lives in a gated community, has armed guards who patrol. It's legal in South Africa to have flamethrowers built underneath your car so that if somebody tries to hijack you, 6-foot-tall flames shoot out from the side of your car. I mean, you can see them on Google, on YouTube. I mean, it's just extraordinary. And virtually everybody of any wealth or income that I spoke to in South Africa has been tied up and robbed in their home at least once. I mean, so massive wealth inequality leads to massive criminality and instability. There's just a point, it might be 50 years down the road, but there's a point where that happens.
So, you know, give me your sense. I mean, obviously, you know, I mean, who knows? But the last time I was doing a remote, let me put it this way. Last time I interviewed you at a remote location,
right,
I think, was at Campaign for America's Future. It was a conference. And I distinctly remember that was like 3 or 4 days after Occupy had started.
Right.
And I had just done a remote in Zuccotti Park and then came down to Campaign for America's Future. And it was fascinating to me. I know you work there, but it was fascinating.
Well, I'm a senior fellow, right, not a fellow, but right, who's okay, counting. Yeah, okay.
What was fascinating to me was that ostensibly that conference was very much about sort of the similar issues.
Right.
But it was the energy, the locus of energy was in Zuccotti Park. I mean, so much so that I think everybody left the conference to march on the steps of Congress,
right,
which I think sort of dovetailed with another sort of Occupy that was happening there or something to that fact. I can't remember. But it was fascinating to me how it had sort of in some ways just caught everybody off guard.
Number one, it caught everybody off guard. You're absolutely right. Number two, and
if I say caught everybody off guard, I mean within sort of like the advocacy world.
Absolutely. No, absolutely. And number two, and what was very interesting about that for me was at that point, instantly, I mean, I resonated with the Occupy thing. I got what they were. Everybody at that point in the activism, not everybody, but the majority of people at that conference and in the activism world and in the liberal politics were saying, this makes no sense. This is not going to have any impact because they don't have a policy platform. And I was saying, yeah, no, I think the brilliance here is that they don't yet have a policy platform. They have a message. And the 99.1% message has absolutely changed the political debate all across the political spectrum from left to right. And it did so almost overnight.
Yes.
And that was because the energy came from an unexpected source. And I think going back to the elites and their fear, that's what they're afraid of, is these spontaneous. They're not afraid of Democratic Party institutions. They're not afraid of liberal institutions to which they give enormous amounts of money every year, like the Center for American Progress or whatever. Those organizations are not a threat to them. Some people getting together in a park and saying, we're not going to do this, and they're laughing that for a week, and then all of a sudden they're changing the political dialogue. That's what frightens them.
Right. And I mean, I guess it, I mean, it's hard to, I had the sense that something like that was happening, that something was changing in terms of, particularly in terms of like inside and outside. I mean, I distinctly remember having, you know, a meeting with the guy who was the head of Current at the time, or the guy they brought in, Borman or whatever, and saying, this was what I think, you know, I was trying to pitch them on what I, on maybe a show that I would want to do on there, or what I thought even where Current should position themselves. In, I think it was December of 10, maybe it was, saying, this... Because it was in the ether. I mean, you know, I'm not saying I'm some type of soothsayer here. It was in the ether, I think, that you probably recognize, that I recognize, that people, I think, who are of our ilk and not as institutionalized recognize what's going on. There is an outsider-insider fight that's going on here. And I don't necessarily have that sense right now. That could be a function of just... Grandpa's getting old. I got a one-year-old, and I'm not out, you know. But I think that the forces are still sort of disparate in some ways. I mean, but with that said, you're absolutely right about it changing the debate.
Yeah. No, look, there was a pretty concerted effort to sort of dissipate the Occupy movement. It was pretty effective. I think you're right. There's nothing in the zeitgeist moving right now the way there was in 2010. But we also know those things can change, and they can change pretty quickly. If there's another market downturn or financial crisis, for example, which is not out of the question by any means, you know, they always say the cycle's 5 to 7 years. Well, guess what? The last crisis was 2008. It's 2014. If there's another shock to the financial system, if another bank goes down, now there are more safeguards than there were, or if there's another unexpected event, we just don't know. Something could shift, and that's what I think that people are worried about.
So if I hear you correctly, RJ, what you're saying is sell, 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 and Danielle Steele, she can go F.
I do not have any positions in the stocks I have been discussing in this program.
So, RJ, all right, so if people want to check out your show, they can do so on YouTube, and
we have a YouTube channel, The Zero Hour. The podcasts are available currently for free on iTunes. We're also broadcast terrestrially on Saturday from noon to 3 in Washington, D.C., Chicago, Ohio, Northern California, and a couple other markets.
Okay, great. So weactradio.org, right?
Probably. And this is the Zero...
You're almost as good at promotion as I am.
I'm not a big promotion guy, but I will say this is thezerohour.com is our website.
Okay, this is thezerohour.com. We will put that on the homepage at majority.fm. RJ, I sincerely hope that you can deal with your issues with Danielle Steele and move forward. Thanks so much for sitting with us today. Really,
always a pleasure, Sam.
All right, folks, we're going to take a quick break, and I want to apologize up front. Like I said, midstream, my computer has had a massive failure. I do not have access to IMs. I won't be taking IMs today. I won't be taking calls. We're going to sit down with Shannon Moore when we come back.
you know, the show will not be, it may be a little bit shorter on the in the better half today because of that. And hopefully I will get this all straightened out by tomorrow. But we're going to take a break. We'll be right back after this. We're going to take a break. Ladies and gentlemen. Oh, there we go. We're back, continuing our coverage at the Mass Torts Convention in Las Vegas. It seems every year that I come here, I run in, well, there are people who are invited to the conference. There are people I run into afterwards. Maybe I'll talk about who I run into. in the casino, But I did not run into her in the casino, but she is here attending the conference, and I couldn't be happier to have her with us. Shannon Moore, folks, she is the host of what? Now, what is your station up in Alaska?
Well,
you're one of the biggest talk show hosts in Alaska.
Except I was on Fox News, and then Fox News decided that I shouldn't be on the air in Alaska. But next week, I start up on a news station because, after 8 years on a Fox News station, they finally figured out that there was a liberal on.
Oh, that's why you didn't. It's Alaska. They may not have checked
it. But, there's just no other liberal hosts on up there. But still on, and we have We Act Radio in Washington, D.C. with a lot of folks, and NetRoots Radio and Progressive Voices. And
so you're going to get back on another station
in Alaska. As soon as I get home.
Oh, well, good. So
It doesn't. It's radio.
Right.
It just goes. It just keeps going.
Well, that's beautiful. And so, all right, there's a bunch of stuff I want to talk to you about.
Awesome. Ready.
Many times you and I have talked, I think, maybe at this conference, actually, in the past, and at NetRoots Nation.
Right.
Over the past, it seems like 2 years now, at least, about the ongoing battle dealing with Pebble Mine. Tell us what Pebble Mine is, what the fight was all about.
Well, it started for me about 8 or 9 years ago. Pebble Mine was a proposed mine, largest open pit mine in North America, ever to be placed at the headwaters of the last wild sockeye run. Like 51% of the world's sockeye salmon come from this bay, and they just thought that'd be a great place to put some cyanide.
And did you meet? Wait a second. Now this is what I remember. You met with their lawyers at one point, right? And they basically said to you, like, oh, we don't give a shit about that.
Right. It was so bizarre. And they were actually not. They were lawyers from the Chamber of Commerce that had come up to help Pebble push this through.
The National Chamber of Commerce.
And what had happened was, we got into this fight for years, and then we said, this is really going to be damaging. We need the EPA to step in and use the 404C of the Clean Water Act, where they can say, you know what, you don't get to start this because you can't do this right. So they don't use it very often.
Right.
And the Chamber of Commerce is like, no way in hell do we want the EPA to get to do that anywhere. If you can do that there, then you can do it anywhere. And, their hair was on fire.
So this is an authority the EPA has to preemptively stop someone essentially from engaging in work that reasonably could lead to the destruction
and it's been used very, very, very few times, but it's part of the Clean Water Act.
Yeah,
very, very few times, but this we felt like warranted it, because once the cyanide's out of the bag, fish are gone. It's too late, and there's not going to be
enough.
That's
an old Alaskan saying. Once the cyanide's out of the bag, the fish are gone.
It is. It's an old saying. So I met with these attorneys, and I was explaining to them about the sort of indigenous way of life and how incredible it was for me to grow up on a fishing boat and how my whole family has been commercial fishing for all these years. And they basically were like, you're probably right. We don't care about your Eskimos. We don't care about your salmon. We don't even care about the golden ground. We care about this precedent being used. And
So in other words, let me just explain this. So they were saying, like, you know what? We're not even that heavily invested in doing this, except for the fact that if we don't do it, it's going to set a precedent where this could hurt us in the rest of the country. So
in
we
fracking.
Just have to basically make an example out of you guys.
Exactly. Then maybe people could use the clean water to stop fracking because, all my cows are bald because of the chemicals and this. You see what I'm saying? They were worried about that. They were worried about mining in West Virginia or Wyoming or whatever.
The look on my face is just sort of just like, that is
so cynical.
It's even beyond that. Like, I don't tend to see things as like evil and good. But if you were going to, let's put it this way. If you're going to put that in a script, a film script, somebody might say, you're going a little over the top there. There's nobody that horrible.
But I'm sitting there.
Where it's like, screw the salmon, screw the Eskimos. We just don't want, we need it. This is essentially like the equivalent in some respects of like Thomas Friedman saying, like, we need to go somewhere.
Right.
To tell them to suck on this. And Iraq was just the place we went. So, sorry, Iraqis.
You win.
We did it there because we could do it. And,
At least he was, at that point. When I had that conversation with that attorney, I actually got what the fight was. And I stopped fighting like hearts and minds as far as those people went. It wasn't any longer about trying to explain to them the value of this place because they weren't going to care.
That's incredibly instructive.
And so then it really changed. Just this week, well, what we did was we went after the shareholders of Anglo-American in Britain.
They're the mining company.
They were a huge partner. Okay. Northern Dynasty only has one holding, and that was Pebble. And then Rio Tinto just this week, they were so angry. Anglo pulled out. Anglo walked away from billions of dollars, right, of investment. And their shareholders were finally like, we're not going to do this, which was we'd been going to their shareholder meetings.
And they just couldn't handle it.
And like after a while, they were like, oh, you know what? These people don't want us there. Let's do this somewhere else.
So they're not as heavily invested in this notion of a precedent because
they're global.
They're global and they're not going to be doing, they're not engaged. I mean, the Chamber of Commerce, from their perspective, they're protecting a half a dozen industries
right.
that like to rape our
pillage
commons.
And plunder.
And so they have to protect that. If you're a specific company who's engaging in mining, that doesn't come up enough for you
right.
that precedent has value. And that was obviously the practical value of getting those chamber lawyers to say that to you. You understood where the pressure
right.
points were for different
so
places.
That was a couple years ago when they said that. So then Anglo pulls out. This week, Rio Tinto, who still owned 10% of the mine.
And where are they based? What company are they based?
Rio's all over the world, and they have they're one of the worst track records ever. I mean, they're really pretty
and they're
brutal.
Mining company.
They own 10% of the mine. They were so mad at Northern Dynasty, this Canadian company that's been running the show, that they donated 10% of the mine to the Bristol Bay Native Corporation. Which
was the people who were agitating
the Native people, the Indigenous people who asked the EPA to come in and do this study, who have been fighting Pebble Mine for years.
Wow.
So they actually took that and donated it back to the Indigenous group. Like, here's 10% of your mine. Not only are we out, we're giving our share to those people. I mean, it was just, it was mind-blowing.
When did this happen?
This week, 2 days ago.
So basically, it's dead. Yes?
Uh-huh.
Hold on one second. I'm giving you a fanfare. You don't know it. I didn't set up headphones for you. Well, that's great.
Yeah.
That's great news.
Yeah. I mean, as long as all those minerals are there, which there's $1 trillion worth of minerals there, this is going to be a fight. But the people in Alaska just aren't going to have it.
Did anybody do a documentary about this?
There's been a couple. One is called, in fact, I'll get you a copy. It's called Red Gold. And it's really about the salmon being the value there. And just about the fight. But nothing's been done
you
up to this point because it's so...
I keep telling this. I find myself telling people they should be writing books all the time. But this is, I think, a very important story just in terms from a tactical standpoint.
Mm-hmm. Well, remember, all of these?
Yes.
I'm showing him the No Pebbles sticker on the back of my phone. Those are on everybody's phone. I mean, we'd go to networks. I mean, 6 years ago,
yes.
We were going, and Liz Winstead was wearing them as pasties in a photo booth show.
Was this 6 years ago?
That we were in Pittsburgh?
Ongoing,
yeah.
Right.
That's when we started doing No Pebble nationally. Myself and Jeannie Devin, the Mudflats, started throwing these parties. Like, come to our party. We brought all this salmon, and let's talk about Pebble. And it's been incredible. I mean, you've given us so many opportunities. Tom Hartman, I mean, Rachel, all kinds of people have...
But I think it's also... It's both instructive in terms of, the activism, but also sort of the strategy here, where you sort of start to cleave off different elements by isolating... What is driving the different constituencies that are fighting for him? I mean,
right.
These multiple partners did not all have the same agenda, and the people who wanted to put the mine there, some of them actually had different reasons that, as those Chamber of Commerce lawyers pointed out, that had nothing to do with that locality.
Well, there are people, even now, there's a state senator who stood up, who was like, Alaska's closed for business. Those poor little mines had to leave because, people like her and him and, they're still defending them and acting
sure.
I mean, it's... the only thing Alaskans really agree on, other than we're really glad Sarah Palin moved to Arizona and there's no pebble mine. I mean, because the salmon are pretty sacred. It's more of a flag than anything else for us. So, you know, I would love to talk to the people that are working on, you know, the Keystone Pipeline and things like that, to like just look at what their strategy is, because there were several different groups, you know, Trout Unlimited, Renewable Resources Coalition, the indigenous groups. There were several people working on this in a larger level, and they didn't always get along with each other.
Right.
Which I actually think wasn't such a bad thing, you know, because they were getting different
agenda. They were hitting at different points.
When Ted Nugent and the Indigo Girls are both willing to do a benefit concert to fight Pebble Mine,
yeah,
you might have everybody else in the country in agreeing. You know what I mean?
Right.
It's like, where do you, if you can pull in both fringe, and like, it was really interesting. But as far as like the Petri dish, that Alaska's always that way, though. I mean, you can look at our politics, because like,
they're small.
It's so small, and
but the like, dynamic.
A dollar that you contribute in Alaska is worth $200 in California, because you only have such a tiny
right.
market. You only have so many TV spots, and you only have 700,000 people, man, women, and child. I mean, there's not that many.
Right.
More people vote for mayor in Seattle than for Senate in Alaska. So the dollar is so low, you know, value is so low there. I mean, you can buy a Senate seat for $1 million.
Yeah, I mean, I guess the point being that it's easier to get your arms wrapped around this, but the dynamics at the end of the day don't change. It's just that the dollar amounts are bigger or smaller, but the actual dynamics that take place, the relationships are just like the relationships and dynamics just about everywhere else. They may be a little bit more complicated in some in bigger states and bigger arenas, because there's more players, but fundamentally the dynamics on how these different players work with each other or don't work with each other is the same.
Like right now, the Koch brothers are buying every single... I mean, there's going to be nothing for anybody to buy. You know, they're just... They can go in and buy up an entire market for what would cost them a week in Sacramento, you know, because of that.
So are they pouring money into Alaska?
Well, they're pouring money in to try to beat baggage, and they've really done some missteps.
I want to talk to you about baggage.
Sure.
Because I have...
Mark.
Well, I mean, aside from all of the other issues that one might have with baggage, the thing that really genuinely interests me is him running on expanding Social Security, because I'm convinced that's a huge winner for Democrats. But before we get to baggage, briefly, I think it was 2 or 3 weeks ago, I became aware that it was the 20th anniversary
25th.
Of the 25th anniversary of the Exxon Valdez, because of a piece you wrote. The idea that this Pebble Mine falls apart almost 25 years to the day is... That's pretty positive. I mean, I don't want to take, you know, it's not too kumbaya, but I mean, it is, I mean, it does speak of some type of understanding of, like, you know.
It was really meaningful, actually, to have that, to have Pebble so getting, you know, just frayed and them falling in on each other, even before the EPA's made a decision, you know. Even though the EPA did come out with a study, it took them 2 years to do it, and they said, even if nothing ever went wrong, you'll damage the salmon. I mean, it's like you're not going to be able to help it. Even if you do everything perfect, it's still going to screw it up. Having that come in at the same time of the 25th anniversary of the Exxon Valdez spill, which I, in that piece I wrote about, you know, being a commercial fisherman and being on the water when that happened and what I saw, and that the average life expectancy for an oil spill worker is 51.
Right.
51 for an oil spill worker who worked on Exxon Valdez because of horrible sicknesses and exposures to Corexit and other chemicals. I think the Corexit was probably more damaging, you know, than even the oil, because it's a dispersant and you're like getting that in your head. And just how devastating that was. And, you know, there was this guy, Don Cornette, who worked for Exxon, and I've always wanted to ask him if he knew he was lying or if they'd lied to him about telling Alaskans they would be made whole. I mean, he stood up and said, "You are so lucky that Exxon did this." I mean, he said that in a school gymnasium full of people. He said, "You're so lucky. We do business right. We will make you whole." And now the guy sells real estate in Houston, Texas. I just always wondered, like...
Have you ever tried to call him up?
No.
You should do that.
But I've really, really wondered. Because I believed him at the time. We all did. We had to.
And, I mean, well, I mean, so what actually did end up happening? I mean...
It actually took us 22 years in court. And the original settlement, which was $5 billion, was knocked down by the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals to $2.5 billion. It went to the Supreme Court. It was knocked to $500 million. And Exxon got, I think, $110 million of that. So all of the fishermen went from $5 billion of damages to about $390 million. And so, you know, thousands of plaintiffs were dead. People had lost their houses because they had mortgaged them to buy their boats, to buy their fishing permits. There were entire runs of herring that have still never returned. And right after the Gulf disaster, BP's disaster in the Gulf, the BBC hired me to go out into Prince William Sound, where the Exxon Valdez is built, to see where it was at and to take a film crew. And I took a shovel because everybody's like, oh, you can dig and find oil. And I didn't even have to dig. I just walked across the beach and my footprints filled up. And it had been 22 years at that point, 23 years. I mean, it's not, you can't clean up an oil spill.
You just gotta call that guy in Houston. I mean, that would be fascinating to just sort of what he said.
Yeah, did he know? I really want to know that. But right now, you know, Shell is drilling, you know, they've been given permits to releases in the Arctic. And Begich and Obama and, you know, because, God, they really suck as, like, these socialist, environmentalist-type people.
It's sometimes hard to get the right...
But Shell just, like, they can't stop crapping in the nest. They're the ones that are going to ruin it for everybody else that wants to drill the Arctic because they had an oil spill response barge that was in Washington State waiting to go to Alaska. They kept getting fined for dumping hydraulic fluid off of the spill response vehicle.
Oh, my God.
Then they wrecked the Kulik, their drill rig. You know, this thing is massive. And a report just came out from the Coast Guard this week that the reason that they wrecked was that they did not have an adequate tow plan, and that the reason that they were even towing that their drill rig was because they were trying to avoid paying taxes. So on January 1st, if you are in port in Alaska, you have to pay a tax. It's just that time. So they went out in a 100-year storm without adequate tow gear to avoid paying taxes when all the deadliest catch boats were tied to the dock.
So,
I mean, they just...
They can't even get ready to go up there without having so many violations Well, that's great, far as I'm concerned, right? I mean, better that they get stopped, that they do crap in the nest for everybody.
Yeah, but they're lucky nobody died on that or trying to rescue that. And it ran aground and bashed all over the place, and now it's in China and dry dock. And they want to say things like, well, the environmentalists or, you know... It's like, they don't know how to drill the... They don't know how to drill there.
Right.
It's too extreme, and they really don't know how to clean up an oil spill anywhere else. Why would we think that they could do it under ice?
Right.
I mean, I've probably said this before, but I would much rather them go into Anwar than drill the Arctic Ocean. And people go, no, you can't go into Anwar. It's like, they have directional drilling, and we know how to clean up oil on land.
Right. I get what you're saying.
So right now they're like...
The failure can't be as catastrophic in Anwar as it
exactly.
can be.
Exactly. And now they're like, all right, you pussy environmentalists, you just keep Anwar there. You just hold on to that like it's your seventh grade bowling trophy that you won back in the day and you got Anwar shut down. And guess what we're going to do? We're going to go kill all the polar bears. Suck it. You know what I mean? It's like, it's no longer... Anwar is no longer a win if that's all you've got, and they're going in there.
Right. That's fascinating and horribly depressing. But let's move.
I know. Sorry.
Well, no. I mean, it is fascinating, though, because on some level, it's do you make some type of trade-off? Like, but, you know, the problem is they'd go into Anwar, and then they'd go into the Arctic.
That is the problem. But if you could say, look, you got 10 years in Anwar, we're going to have, like... You know, people climbing all up your hindquarters, checking out and making sure this is safe. We want you to do it directionally. You got 10 years. Suck it out and get it out. And then you're done. But
yeah, but then they go to the...
They don't have to make that deal.
Right.
They don't have to make that deal. I mean, for all the, like, New World Order and all that stuff, it's like, just look who's running, you know, that the circumpolar north right now. It's all energy companies.
Right. All right. Well, let's turn to Begich, because I don't have a sense of Begich in the main as a senator. You obviously know him, and you know, you talk about Alaska politics. You know him.
I know him really well.
Very well. So, I'm very curious about how it is playing his running on expanding Social Security, because I'm convinced that that's a recipe for the rest of the country. You're telling me that there's a lot of Koch money that's coming in there, Koch brother money, and...
Which is actually fantastic for him right now, that the Koch brothers are spending so much money.
Because he has somebody to run against.
Because the Koch brothers just closed their refinery. They had a huge refinery in North Pole, Alaska, near Fairbanks. They closed it, and they've left now over 300 homes with tainted water. So here it is. They can't drink their water. They closed the refinery, so all those jobs are gone there in a pretty small area, right? And then the governor just said, you know what? We'll just clean that up. Don't worry about it. We'll just take that on. Okay, so for Mark Begich right now, the Koch brothers aren't particularly popular with those decisions and leaving that mess. And so, and he does. He has someone to run against, and he's hit him really hard. And I'm glad he is. I mean, he's not pussyfooting around. They put up a couple of ads, really misleading. They used one woman who was like, it's hilarious, Sam, because she's like, she's in this really ritzy, beautiful kitchen, and she's like, I just don't know if I can trust you, Mark Begich, and da-da-da-da-da.
This is the ad that they're running around the country, right?
It was a woman from Maryland.
Right. And people
And people in Alaska are like, nobody has a kitchen like that here. And like, who the hell's that woman? And like, they just basically threw it out the window and were offended. And one of the first things the Begich campaign did was say, she's not an Alaskan. Right. I haven't misled her. I don't even know her. She lives in a different state. I mean, he just like...
And when you have a state with 700,000 people...
We know.
That, but that claim in and of itself...
I've never seen her at Costco.
Yes, I mean, that claim is actually sort of like... It has even that much more sort of resonance.
That actually matters because there.
And you do that in New York. Like, I don't know that lady. She's an actress. Yeah, I know. So isn't like half the people in the city or, you know...
But there it actually... Yeah. So he's really playing on that. And, you know, a lot of people come up and they have consultants and they want to do, you know, from out of state. And they want to run stuff that doesn't make any sense. It doesn't resonate at all with Alaskans. But he's actually got a pretty good team that's actually making...
All right, well, so tell me about the Social Security expansion. I mean, do you have a sense of that? Is that playing? Is he pushed that hard? Is that a big issue? I think he's just getting to it.
I mean, we have a governor who said no to the Medicaid expansion. Mm. So 41,000 Alaskans, which doesn't sound like that many to some people, but
about 8%, right?
Exactly. They're locked out. And they won't get... I mean, they're in that bubble where they can't get the subsidies to get help, and they make too much, they make too little, you know, that thing. So they're in that...
They're somewhere between 100 and 133% of poverty.
Exactly. And so our governor, by not expanding it, locked out 41,000 people. They're listening to Begich and hearing about... I mean, they know Begich was pushing for that was there. And I think he's trying to push not only... both of those things, Social Security and that expansion.
Well, how does the rest of the state view that? I mean, you know, I imagine you have a very good sense. I mean, if 41,000 people are involved, 8%, maybe 7% of the population.
Part of what people probably don't realize is that Alaska didn't really go through the recession in 2008 like other places did, because 33.5% of the people work for the government. So...
How is this not more of a blue
third,
state?
Exactly. A third of the people work for government. I mean, there's huge military bases. There's, like, I mean, the airports, the roads, everything. I mean, a third of the people work for the government. So they're already getting government health care, right?
Uh-huh.
We've got people, the Indian Health Services. Our indigenous people have medical care through the Indian hospitals there, including Sarah Palin's grandchildren.
God bless her.
God bless her heart. Bless her heart. But, there's Indian Health Services there. There's the VA. We have the highest percentage of veterans in the country live in Alaska. So all these people already have government health care. So it's like nobody's talking about death panels and all that crap. So it's like why our governor felt like he could just be like, no. I mean, people are upset about it. There's letters to editor all the time. But he's very alecky, and he has that support, and he's also kind of a
American
true believer.
Legislative Exchange Council, you're talking about.
Yeah.
Okay. And
very Koch ideology.
And, of course, I mean, we could talk about Begich's gun vote. I mean, talk about that for a moment. Because I imagine, my guess is just sort of culturally speaking, in Alaska, guns have a lot more resonance than they do, say, in, well, probably any other state. I mean,
It's... A gun in Alaska means it's like going to the grocery store.
All right.
You know, I know that may sound silly, but, you know, people, and especially when I was a kid, I think I was 5 or 6 the first time I ever had beef. You know, it's like, it was, people eat moose and they eat caribou, and for a long time there wasn't the same sort of stores. You know, now we have Costco, so people can go there, whatever. But it is really cultural, and certainly the indigenous people, they're very subsistence-oriented. My family's still really subsistence-oriented. So it's more like, I remember actually getting in a conversation maybe 8 or 10 years ago where I was like, I do not understand why people are so freaked out about guns.
Huh.
I was like, I don't get it. And I was talking to Jeannie Devin, who's from New Jersey, and she's like, what's wrong with you? You know, she's like, and then the first time I went to New York, which was just a few, I don't know, 5 or 6 years ago, I was like, oh, that would be freaky here.
Right.
You know, whereas, you know, you're in wide open space. So in Alaska, Begich has to do that.
Right.
He has to do that. We've had school shootings. We've had things that, I mean, you know, years ago we've had you know, principal and student shot in a really tiny school by a kid that was bullied. We've gone through that, but it's like,
What is the percentage of gun ownership in Alaska? Do you know?
I think it's higher than it is anywhere.
I would imagine.
I have several.
Huh. And you've got them, I notice you've been walking around the casino here with them strapped to your waist.
No, I don't think I need them outside of Alaska.
No, wait, do you think you need them in Alaska, or is it more...
I have a really interesting YouTube you should watch of me being charged by a grizzly bear.
And what?
Let me just tell you, Liz Winstead was there.
Oh, she got charged by the grizzly bear?
Yeah, she was on the bank of the Kulik River with me. She was on the bank when I got charged, and I was in the water. Yeah.
What were you doing in the water?
I was fly fishing.
All right, and did you see the bear? You saw the bear, though.
Oh, yeah.
Right? You said, he's not going to charge me, and then he charged you.
Actually, they were all over. There were probably 13 or 14 bears you could see from where we at, and this one decided I shouldn't be there.
Okay, and so then what did you do, cast your rod at him?
No, I found out that my waders were waterproof both ways. No, I stood my ground.
Yeah, did you shoot him?
No, I didn't shoot it. I just stood there, and he got up to me and stood up and popped his jaws a couple of times, and I was... You really want to hear this part?
Wait a second.
I was looking...
How far away were you from the bear?
At which point? When it started running or when it stopped?
When it stopped, like at the closest point.
I don't know. 8 feet? 10 feet?
Now, aren't bears about 8 feet tall?
He was about 12. Because when he stood up, he was not happy. And he was kind of,
did you
kind of rolling around. Oh, yeah, I did.
Because
people did watching it. It wasn't like this bear wanted to make love.
Right. Okay.
So
that also, I don't think would be terribly pleasant for him, frankly. So
no. Just relax. Your body has a way of shutting this whole thing down. So I was looking up at it, and then I looked down because I'm thinking, oh, you're not supposed to make eye contact. Then I was thinking, I hope this doesn't hurt for very long. And then I thought, oh my, what big balls you have. Because this bear had these giant balls, like, right out of the water, right in front of me. I thought, wow. And then I like looked back up at him, and he looked at
me.
He looked at me like, you're checking out my balls, like. And then he just like rolled off and went down. And he was
so, you defended yourself with flattery. You used flattery. You flattered the bear.
So if you don't have a weapon with you, you can just say what huge balls you have.
Okay. Well, I mean, all right, but that doesn't necessarily make the case that you should have guns. I mean,
I worry about people more than I worry about bears.
Right. I mean,
and you know, I'm from Alaska, and there's a lot of people that I still consider the Palaban or the Palinistas.
Mm-hmm.
And you know,
so what are you gonna do? You gonna shoot them?
Well, I have a .22 that I carry at home. I've had law enforcement tell me to. When they're looking at emails and seeing threats and stuff.
Yes, I can understand that, actually, from your perspective.
I don't want to shoot anybody.
Right. I mean, when Air America launched, Janine and I would literally walk home. She bought us both two aluminum bats, and we were supposed to have security. Now, this is you know, less than a year after the beginning of the invasion and occupation of Iraq, and she was getting extensive threats.
Right.
And I could imagine a scenario where we'd be like, we should be packing heat. We had aluminum baseball bats, but...
do you want to hit somebody?
Well, yeah, that's what we would do. I mean, most of the people want to come up and say, you know, we would take a baseball bat. But I understand. I mean, it's fascinating. It's also just... Alaska's just a very different place, I think, in
well, and when you don't know who's coming up and talking to you...
No.
It can get a little weird.
All right. I mean, for me, I'm really curious about that Social Security thing. So, you know, keep an eye on that. Let me know.
I will.
Shoot me an email and tell me about...
I will, yeah. And, you know, I think Begich is playing this race pretty smart. He's got some interesting people running against him.
Who are the... Is it a bunch of Tea Partiers or...
Joe Miller's back.
Okay.
Joe Miller's back. Love me some Joe Miller. He's got the crazy.
Yeah.
But you know what? He's so much more honest than Lisa Murkowski.
Now, is Murkowski running again?
No, she's not up for another
right.
two.
Okay.
So Joe's there. Meade Treadwell, who's the current lieutenant governor. And then this Dan Sullivan, who was a former Bush appointee. Then Sarah Palin put him in as attorney general.
Uh-huh.
Then he went to resources. He's one of those people in the system that they've sent to Alaska to run for Senate this year.
Interesting.
So they put him in the, you know, and he's an interesting guy. He's from Ohio, and he's had this huge sort of political career thing. But I don't think he's going to be able to beat Begich because he's made a couple of mistakes. One was that he marked his residence in Maryland as his primary residence. So that he could get a tax break on it, but he's at the same time he's been living in Alaska for years. So he lied on. So Alaskans are kind of funny about like, hey, we're your girl. You don't wink at somebody else, kind of thing.
Well, it's also sort of illicit.
It's dishonest,
right?
But here was the kicker, and this is so Alaska, is that the first year he was there, he registered for a non-resident fishing license. The next year, he said he had been there for 1 year and got residence. The next year, he said he'd been there for 2 years and had residence. And the next year, he said he would have been there for 10 years.
Wow. So he has trouble counting.
So he has a math problem.
Yeah.
And at the same time, he's declaring residency and that he's been here all of a sudden for 10 years. And I know Alaska can feel like a long time.
Right.
Some winters, you're
right.
Like, really? But you can't. I mean, if you're getting all these tax breaks in another state, you don't get to say...
Of course.
So people will be like, that's stealing a fish. That's stealing resources from Alaska. That's how they're going to look at...
I don't even think that's unique to Alaska. I mean, nobody likes the idea of like, hey, I'm cheating on my taxes. That's
right.
Basically what he's doing, right?
Right, on his house. But as far as Alaska goes, it's like you're a tourist.
Right.
You know what, buddy?
Right.
You're a tourist.
Wow. Well, obviously, Begich is one of the key races. You know,
yeah,
he's shaping up like Michigan
one of the
and
six.
Georgia, right? Are going to be the sort of the go-to, but the Democrats need that to hold the Senate. And
So it'll be interesting going forward.
You know, and on the gun vote, I mean, there have been a lot of votes where I was like, really? You know, and I don't have a problem texting him and being like, really? Right. You know, which I'm sure he loves. But you know, the Affordable Care Act, he had to be there.
Yeah.
If anybody else would have been in that spot.
That's right. Yeah. All right. Well, Shannon Moore, thank you so much. Now, where people can go and check out your show on We Act Radio for now.
Yep.
We Act
ShannonMooreShow.com. They can just go there and there's all the links. And
great. And you also have a column that comes out on a weekly basis, or is it just...
Every Sunday. Anchorage Daily News.
And you probably have it on ShannonMoore.com, right? Or at least linked.
What's that?
Do you have it on your website as well?
Yeah. And they run on Huffington and...
Great.
You know, they're around.
Shannon, thank you so much.
Always good to talk to you. Thanks, too, for... I mean, I love coming and telling you what's happening with Pebble when I've come to you so many times and been like, Sam, help us fight this
fight. I think it's such an important story. Just, I mean, both... It's really encouraging to hear about wins. Like, it reminds me... I had Josh Fox on the day that the frackers basically pulled out of the Marcellus Shale about 3 or 4 months. I've lost track of time. But again, it was a sort of a similar fight. It was just like, hang in there, make it unprofitable for these people and a pain in the ass for them, and it starts to implode. And I also just think there's so much to be learned, both from the fact that it was impossible to know why the U.S. Chamber of Commerce was so specifically, why they specifically were so interested in this. And to know that their interest in it had nothing to do with the locality, not even the money that was going to be made there, nothing, is a great lesson about how you can't assume what is driving the interests of these things. You got to find out.
Or how you're going to combat it.
Right.
Like, I was so convinced before that day, if I just take you out there and I show you these crazy bears that are everywhere and I take you fishing and you meet some of these people and realize their people have been here 10,000 years.
The hearts would start to play.
Exactly. You'll then have the same understanding I do, which is that this place is worthy of protection.
Right.
That was absolute
from their perspective,
crap.
We don't care if it's a toxic waste dump or, frankly, the Garden
like,
of Eden.
They were like, you're probably right. That mine will probably kill those fish. This isn't about that. We don't care about that.
Yeah, it's really hard to imagine people saying that.
It's dark,
but it's
like, that's the way it is. And I think the quicker we can, like, shift and start fighting that way.
Yes.
I mean, you need hearts and minds of people to care about and support your cause, but as far as the people you're fighting, they don't care.
Right. I mean, I think, it remains to be seen what's going to happen with Keystone, but there were definitely multiple fronts that could have been hit on a national level in some ways. And I know certainly people were fighting the eminent domain sort of angle in like Nebraska and Texas.
Right. Why we can't get the Tea Party and the Enviros on the same team.
There was some of that was happening, but it seemed the narrative wasn't national enough to force people to take sides in sort of these national organizations that would have made a big difference, right? I mean, because we all know the response from Kelo and that New London, Connecticut eminent domain case, how it sparked sort of this national right-wingers on a national level were pissed about it. And also people on the left, I think, to a large extent, too. But because of why they took it, it was future tax revenues that would come from... The idea being that there are multiple strategies that can be followed, and you need to really know not necessarily what's going to convince you why you're in the fight. You've got to know why they're in the fight to defeat them, and that's what it comes down to.
Yeah, it's a whole new tactic, and this Pebble story, I think...
write an e-book about it.
Yeah.
Or a full book. I mean,
Or have a Netroots panel.
Yeah, I would go a little further.
Do people go to those?
I don't know. I'll tell you in Chicago. All right, Shannon, we'll see you in Chicago.
Detroit. It's in Detroit this year.
Detroit.
But they're near each other. I got to get on a plane to get to either one. Did your entire hard drive go away?
Honestly, to look at your computer and not see anything you recognize, I dug out the broadcast device on my computer after like 45 minutes
I can't seem to get anything else to work. It is so disorienting. I had been debating whether or not to buy a new computer. And, you know...
So who won that debate?
Well, I was debating with myself.
Right. And the new computer's winning.
No, well, the new computer lost and now has just catapulted into the forefront. But... And I'm not going to lie. I'm in Las Vegas. I like to play blackjack. My cousin was unexpectedly in town, so I met with him late last night. I also had one of the most bizarre... Well, I'll tell you this, Shannon.
So funny, I just saw my cousin for the first time in 30 years. He's at this conference.
Well, I see my cousin... the first time in 30 years?
Yeah, I haven't seen him in 30 years, and he's a traveler.
You knew he was going to be here.
We knew each other were going to be here, but it's the first time we've seen each other in 30 years.
Wow.
Yeah, it's kind of fun.
Did you guys have a falling out, or...?
No, he's from West Virginia. In fact, he represented 20 of those miners' families that were blown up.
I think I'm going to talk to him. Is that Mark?
Yeah, I think. Well, I don't know if you're or not. I hope so. His name is Lee Javens. He's representing all those businesses in Charleston, including, you know, his own home where they're not using water still.
I do want to talk to him.
He's very cool.
Tomorrow I'm going to be talking to... a bunch of lawyers, and I think he was on the list. I hope he is. If not, I want to get him on
the list. So you were out with your cousin? I was out with my cousin. My computer, I don't even know if it's working today.
You haven't even checked it. Well,
anyway, thanks so much for having me, though.
Oh, my pleasure. All right, folks. I'm going to wrap it up here. I will tell this story. And, Shannon, you can stick around and listen if you want. Last time I was here... I come to these things twice a year, although I haven't been in over a year because I just had a new child, and so I had to stay at home.
The new baby smell.
New baby smell. And last time I was here, I was sitting at a blackjack table. It was the NAB conference. I was here. I think it was the first night I was here. I had done well. I was up by, like, I don't know, $75 or $100, and I was feeling good about it, and I'm walking to the elevators, and I just hear, like, this craps table going crazy. And this probably is actually a Name Drop Friday segment, folks, but I'll do it anyways. So I look over, and I see David Cross and Will Arnett. David and I, old friends. Will Arnett, good friends from back in the day when we were both doing voiceovers. And they're with the guy from Netflix who I knew from ages ago because I had done a movie, and they apparently were here for Arrested Development. But I walked up, hadn't seen Cross in months, hadn't seen Will in a couple of years at least, hadn't seen this other guy. It was 1 in the morning, 12 o'clock maybe at night. And then I had to explain to my comedian friends, like, what I'm doing at a tort conference, which... was just bizarre, and then we proceeded to sit down at the blackjack table, and I ended up losing like $250. But last night, I'm sitting at a blackjack table. Guy's dealing, and I keep losing. I guess I was doing okay, but he was taking a lot of my money. And I see the guy's name is Michael, and I'm just thinking, God, Michael is really blowing it for me. And then he starts talking to myself and Scott Milliken, producer of Ring of Fire. And I look up at him, and I realize I know this guy. And I'm like, Mike, it's Sam Cedar. And he's like, holy crap, I was just about to say to you, you should look up this guy Sam Cedar on your phone because you look just like him. I hadn't seen him in 15 years. He was an actor in a movie I made. From years ago. And he had a very tough go of it for a long time. And I guess ended up in Vegas and was dealing cards now. It was just so bizarre.
Did you start winning after that?
No, I think we both got really uncomfortable on some level. I'm not sure why. And later in the evening, I came back. So I'm basically at parity right now. But today is the day I'm going to go out and I'm going to win a new computer. That's my goal.
Today's the day.
Today's the day, or tomorrow is tomorrow.
Get your luck on.
Yeah, exactly.
Awesome.
All right, folks. That is our program for today. Tomorrow on the program, I'm hoping to talk to at least a couple of attorneys about some of the cases they're working on, presuming I can get my computer fixed. Because this is a bit of a problem. But hopefully I'll be able to fix it today and we won't have any problems. Tomorrow I'll be able to take some IMs and hopefully some phone calls as well. Oh, I just got an IM from, I can't tell if it was Michael or Matt. Win us new ones too. All right, well, I'm going to win Matt. Michael, you've got a relatively new computer. Matt will get the first one, then Michael. All right, folks. See you tomorrow.
It might take all the strength I got to get to where I want.